This is the Science Set Free podcast. I'm Rupert Sheldrake and I'm here with Mark Vernon. And today we're talking about...
Well, I wondered if we might like to talk about what you might call the spiritual uses of science.
The spiritual uses of science, yes.
And what particularly interests me, Rupert, is the way that often in writings about spirituality... references to science are made. And I wonder, you know, kind of what work, if you like, the science is being asked to do often in these situations. Is it sort of proving the spiritual point, or is it being used as a metaphor, or, I don't know, to give the discussion some kind of weight? Maybe, should I give an example of what
yes,
I mean?
Yes, do, yes.
I think about quantum physics and quantum mechanics, and I believe there's even a sort of division of spirituality right now, which is sometimes referred to as quantum spirituality. But broadly, the idea seems to be that some of the weird phenomena in quantum physics, and they're definitely weird, are sort of borrowed to make more broader spiritual points. So you get people often, say, referring to quantum entanglement.
Yeah.
This idea that quantum subatomic particles can be entangled so that you can tweak one and it seems instantaneously the other particle reflects this tweaking in some way.
Yes.
And this has been, you know, measured. I know this has been observed and measured. I read something recently that said the quantum entanglement had been observed over a distance of 120 kilometres quite recently, which is effectively infinite in quantum mechanical terms. So you get this idea that information could spread instantaneously throughout the cosmos. Now, I mean, this has sort of... obvious appeal, I guess, if you're a theist or you believe in other kinds of transmission of information, I suppose. But I suppose what I wonder is this just a useful metaphor? Entanglement's a metaphor that then you use to explore macro phenomena? Or does it relate more tightly to the macro phenomena, as if it's almost sort of proves it? Sometimes you read people writing and it's almost like it proves it's the case.
Yes. Well, I suppose, in this case, I think it's just a metaphor. The thing is, quantum entanglement works with very specialist quantum systems. In order to observe it, you have to stop the system undergoing decoherence, because it's rather hard to preserve an entangled state. That's why it's hard to measure over long distances. And some people have tried to extend it to things like telepathy. Dean Radin, in his book Entangled Minds, uses this metaphor, saying that just as quantum particles that have interacted remain linked at a distance, so minds that have interacted may remain linked at a different distance, entangled, and so change in one can affect the other. But it's amazing how controversial this is if you take the metaphor seriously within a scientific context. And even among many parapsychologists, there are those who say this is an invalid use of the metaphor, and quantum physics is a very special set of systems. You've got to prepare them carefully. You've got to do these measurements, and you can hardly observe these phenomena in the macroscopic world. So... it's exceedingly controversial, and to extend it all the way to spirituality would be even more so if anyone took the metaphor seriously. It would be opposed every inch of the way by many people within the scientific world.
But also within the, well, say, parapsychology or the spiritual world too.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I myself think that what we have is a series of metaphors or scientific words which are used to try and give things validity. People feel that if it has the imprimatur of science, it must be more credible. And, I mean, the areas where this happens most today are in quantum, there's the quantum self, quantum society, quantum brain, quantum spirituality, quantum medicine, you know, there's all these things. The other one is neuro, this, neuro that, neuro spirituality and so on.
Yeah.
The idea being that if you can show a brain scan with an fMRI pattern lighting up somewhere in the brain to do with any phenomenon you're talking about, somehow it renders it more credible.
Yeah. I was thinking what would be interesting is if you had a phenomenon and the brain didn't light up. Now, that would be interesting.
Well, then they'd just say it was defective equipment or something, or not sensitive enough.
Yes. Let me just go to the quantum area again, because another area which you see written about and talked about is the role of observers. And this is to do with the collapse of the wave function, I believe is the technical phrase, and the idea that... because you get the superposition of states in quantum systems where things can be, as it were, both on and off, or zero and one, however you want to represent it. And it's not that it seems that it's not until someone or something observes, looks, that it becomes either one or the other.
Yes.
It's captured in the famous Schrödinger's cat thought experiment. The thing that's intriguing here is it does seem to be on this cusp of the quantum world and the macro world. You know, if observers are things like human beings. So again, that you can sort of feel the pull that, you know, consciousness perhaps is some kind of fundamental constituent of the universe, because it's required to collapse the wave function and produce the tangible world in which we actually live.
Yes.
That's the kind of logic that's taken. I mean, what do you make of that?
Well, again, I'm sort of rather disappointingly sceptical on that one. You see, I think the consciousness thing is overrated in quantum physics, because basically what quantum physics is saying there is that observations require observers. Well, Schopenhauer said that, you know, in the early 19th century. You know, he said science is trying to leave out the observer, but all observations require observers. Now, scientists simply ignored that until quantum physics came along, and they were a bit more sophisticated and had to include the observer. More specifically, in order to make an observation in quantum theory, what you find depends on what kind of experiment you do, which is, again, a general truth. You know, if you set up an experiment that measures waves, you can measure the wave aspect of quantum particles. If you set up a particle experiment, you get particles. So it's not really any more profound than saying, you know, if you want to catch fish and you have a one-foot mesh, you're not going to catch anything that's sort of very small. You'll just catch really big fish. You know, the kind of system you set up affects what you get. So I don't really think it's a lot more profound than that. I mean, because it applies to all experiments, and indeed the more general point in quantum theory is that when the quantum system interacts with something, then it changes, that you get the collapse of the wave function whenever there's any interaction. But in a lab, the interaction they're interested in is the way it interacts with the measuring equipment. But it's going to interact all the time. I mean, the light is quantum particles. As we look out of the window, there's sunlight beaming down on the leaves of trees. Now, every time a photon interacts with the leaf, there's a collapse of the wave function. Every interaction in nature is happening all the time.
So it doesn't need to be special observers?
It doesn't, no. So it doesn't require special observers. So again, I think that's extrapolating way beyond what's legitimate.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd love these things to be true, but the fact is that a lot of these things are extrapolated way beyond what the actual science will bear.
Okay, well, let me give you, let's say, here's a third sort of case. We thought a little bit about entanglement, and then also about the need or not for observers. The other area, which again, I feel I've seen, concerns the interpretation of quantum mechanics. And so this is the idea that whilst quantum theory is, in a way, science's most successful theory of all time in terms of the predictions it makes to the precision, and then how those predictions can be observed to come about, there's this huge debate about whether quantum theory is just a very powerful tool, or whether it describes the world as it is in itself, or whether there's a kind of veil of ignorance, as it were, that separates us from reality. Now, again, this has a kind of appeal if you're theologically minded, because it mirrors a little bit ideas about how we human beings, say, have an experience of God or the spiritual dimension of life, but it's always constrained by our humanity, by our mortality, by our finitude. And as it were, we never quite reach the thing in itself. We get glimpses of eternity, but then realise that it's time for tea, you might say.
Yes.
Or we have the ecstasy and then have to do the washing up. So I wonder whether, though, again, there's sort of, you know, parallels here about the interpretation of quantum mechanics. Is it the same thing being replicated at the very small?
Again, I didn't necessarily think so. I mean, there's many interpretations of quantum mechanics, and you know, one of them, every time you make an observation, the world splits, and you get millions of parallel universes. I mean, that seems to me quite absurd interpretation of it. But there are lots of them, and they don't seem to constrain, don't seem to be constrained by reality very much. I'm not sure that, again, those, I mean, they can be metaphors for the difficulty of interpreting what we can observe. But I don't think they shed much light on the spiritual realm. So my own feeling is that most of these things in science have a very limited range of application. And I suppose I don't take the sciences so seriously as being the only source of valid metaphor that some people seem to think. You know, they're the things that are most impressive in the modern world. I don't really see it that way. And I think the things that the sciences do tell us that are of... I think there are sort of real findings in science as opposed to metaphors that tell us something important. And one of them, for example, is the placebo effect in medicine. Now, this is a hard finding. Nobody disputes the existence of the placebo effect. It's, you know, the most hardcore reductionist materialist admits that it happens. It's usually, or used to be, regarded as a nuisance in clinical trials. Now it turns out that it's happening in regular medicine on an order basis. It's happening in all forms of therapy. And so we have this effect, the placebo response, where people take a blank pill or undergo some kind of surgical procedure that's actually a sham, and they get better. Now, why? It seems to depend on their expectation and their beliefs. And if people think they're taking a powerful new drug that's going to make them better, or that they might be taking it, they often get better. Now, the thing that matters there is expectation or belief. And if you tell people, these people in this clinical trial are getting the powerful new drug, sorry, you're only getting the blank pill, the placebo effect is much less effective. It's much less effective if the doctor knows who's giving the pills. Oh, well, you know, the patients may not know, but the doctor knows, well, these people are just getting the blank pill. It depends on the doctor's and the patient's expectations. So I think here we've got a case where scientific research is showing us something that's, I think, an established scientific fact, the power of the placebo effect, and where we're immediately in the realm that borders on spirituality. Because you could say that it's a form of faith cure, that if you believe that you're getting a powerful pill or a powerful new form of medicine or some kind of wonder treatment, you'll get better with a greater probability than if you don't believe it.
I wonder if you could test this, you know, because we speak at the time when the new Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, DSM-5, is just about to come out, or just has come out, perhaps. And there's a huge hoo-ha going on about this at the moment in high psychiatry and psychology about whether biomedical models of so-called mental illness really stack up. So you could imagine how if in, say, 10 or 20 years' time, the very common belief now, I guess, that there's a pill for depression, there's a pill for anxiety, a pill for this. Not in terms of keeping down the symptoms and helping people to manage the symptoms, which I think can often help, but in terms of sort of curing the problem. If that belief, as it were, as the science seems to be now questioning, followed through into wider society, you could presumably measure whether the placebo effect in similar kind of conditions fell off as well. If we stopped believing there was a pill for this and a pill for that.
I think it probably would. And in the case of America, where they allow direct consumer advertising, where on TV you get drug adverts, prescription drugs advertised straight to people, we've actually seen the reverse, that there's been an increase in people's belief in wonder drugs. And one of the things that's happened in the US, but not elsewhere, in the last 10 years, is that placebo effects have been increasing rather than decrease. And the opposite of what you were suggesting. I mean, you were suggesting how they could wane. I'm just saying there's actual evidence they can do the opposite. They can increase. They probably wane as well. And there's been a lot of discussion of this, because what it means is that placebos are working better and better in these clinical trials. People's expectations of wonder drugs are so high that the fact they're in a trial where they might be getting it, getting bigger placebo effects. So it's becoming harder and harder for drug companies to show that these drugs work better than placebos, because the placebo effects are going up. So a lot of promising drugs have been rejected on the grounds they know no better than placebos. Not because the drugs are less effective than similar drugs in the past, but because placebos have got stronger. So in a sense, the drug companies have shot themselves in the foot by raising expectations. And there's a whole subject of medical anthropology where I've seen some interesting studies where they've looked at placebo effects in different countries. And there's quite a big difference in these effects, because people's background beliefs influence what happens in these trials. In Germany, there's an obsession with heart disease, much more so than in anywhere else in Europe. And the Germans have a diagnostic category that most people don't have: Herz insufficiens, insufficient heart activity. And they get very worried about low blood pressure. Well, no one in England or America gets worried about low blood pressure, only high blood pressure. But the Germans have this whole thing about blood pressure and heart. Their death rates from heart attacks are similar to France and Britain, so it's not as if they're more prone to heart disease. But placebo effects in heart drugs are much different in Germany than they are in other cultures. So here's something where we've got hard science, real results from that are themselves not disputed, not based on dodgy interpretations or anything, which are telling us how much our beliefs and expectations and the social context in which we find ourselves influence our health and disease.
So what that makes me wonder then is this human psychology, or is it properly something to do with spirituality? And when you're talking there, it reminded me of an observation that I think Carl Jung made, actually, where he talks about how he noticed when he was a psychiatrist how a kindly word can have as much impact upon someone as a drug, in terms of reducing symptoms, at least.
Yes.
And that would be within the realms of human psychology, I suppose. Do you think it's right, or there's room to invoke the spiritual dimension in relation to the placebo as well?
Well, I think here's a case where it's rather hard to tell where ordinary psychology leaves off and where a spiritual dimension comes in. Because many people who have spiritual practices pray. I pray myself. I pray for members of the family if they're sick. Pray for myself if I'm sick. And so my hope and expectation about what's going to happen actually almost seamlessly blend into the kind of realm of spiritual practice, particularly prayer. So I don't think there is a sharp dividing line. And you could say that, you know, when people are being treated at a hospital in a new clinical trial, there's a kind of ritual element to the sort of medicine. They're admitted, the doctors and nurses are wearing special uniforms. The hospital has a kind of, you could say, almost a temple-like atmosphere in some ways. And you could say that the whole of this and the rituals, the medical rituals that they're put through, a part of the placebo response as well.
And I suppose that you said there that before that what the doctor's expectations matter as much as what the patient's expectations are. So we're talking about the whole system here as well, aren't we? It's not just individuals, but it's the whole psychic system in which they're enmeshed, as it were, that matters.
And then they're enmeshed in a larger social and economic system, which includes drug companies wanting to develop new drugs so they can make more profit. And, you know, people who hope that science will come up with answers for various diseases, and there's a kind of general social expectation. I mean, it's part of the belief in progress. So, and one could argue that the general belief in progress is a faith position, because, indeed, it's it's saying things are going to get better, history is leading to somewhere better than where it is now. That's not what most people in most of human history have believed. In fact, in Hindu models of time, things are generally speaking getting worse. So there's so many dimensions to these beliefs that it's very hard to say where ordinary psychology leaves off and something else comes in.
So I wonder where you feel how to conduct this conversation, this interaction between, say, the scientific and the spiritual. Because I suppose that I'm inclined to feel that spiritual practices, spiritual traditions, insights should really try and kind of rest on their own authority, rather than sort of borrowing from the science, as it were, to try and bolster their status in some way. Partly because the science changes so fast, actually. So yes, you can build a spiritual system on quantum physics one decade, but it's changed within a decade or two as well. So have some kind of exchange, but nonetheless to trust, as it were, the authority upon which the spiritual rests, as much as you would do, of course, on of the authority on which the science rests.
Well, I agree. And in the 19th century, when people in the spiritual realm, especially theosophists, they wanted to make what they were saying credible, they borrowed terminology from science. And then people believed that light propagated through the ether and that space was pervaded by the ether, a form of subtle matter. And that was a mainstream scientific concept. So they borrowed it and talk about the etheric body and that kind of thing. Then in 1905, Einstein showed we don't need the ether, we just have electromagnetic fields and fields in general. But still, if you read theosophical literature today, the etheric body is still there. So we've got what's now seen as esoteric language, which was an attempt to clothe what they were doing in the language of science, but science has moved on. So I think, yes, I agree with you on that. And I think there are areas, though, where science directly interfaces. And the placebo effect is one. Another one is mindfulness, meditation, and prayer. And there have been a whole range of studies in the United States showing that people who have regular religious practice tend to live longer and are less prone to depression than those that don't. These are robust findings, many often replicated, you know, longer life expectancies. With white males, I think people who have regular religious practices tend to live 4 or 5 years longer. With black males in America, it's about 15 years longer. Now, you could say this involves lots of social factors, maybe better social support, maybe less proneness to drug addiction or something like that. There's many factors involved, but these are measurable facts. These data also show that people who pray and meditate regularly tend to have better health, better recovery from health crises, and so forth. And this is then where mindfulness meditation is now entered in a sense into the scientific realm, because it's now being used in the National Health Service, because it's been shown that through outcome studies that people who do it get less depressed or whatever. And so I think here we've got something where there's a valid interface between religious practice and science, where the science can actually measure effects and with practical consequences, because if you can actually show mindfulness meditation increases people's health and reduces their proneness to depression, and if it's cheaper than drugs, then already decisions have been made in the National Health Service, okay, let's roll out mindfulness training programs and so on.
It's interesting, isn't it, because the the evidence, as it were, has to be put together that mindfulness, say, is more effective than CBT, which I believe is one of the findings that's becoming more mainstream and accepted. Mm. CBT, as it were, has been useful, but it's, in a way, had its heyday.
Behavioural therapy.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that if cognitive behavioural therapy is more about trying to control thoughts, mindfulness is more about accepting difficult thoughts, and that seems to actually be more efficacious.
Mm.
So that there's this sort of shift going on. But when you read the mindfulness literature, which I'm very interested in too, the Buddhist tradition is never far away. And of course, I think one of the people who's done most of the work in terms of getting mindfulness accepted onto the NHS is Mark Williams at Oxford, who's also an Anglican clergyman.
Mm.
He's a canon at Christ Church Cathedral.
Mm.
So that it's interesting how The spirituality is kind of there. The spiritual tradition is there. And it will be interesting to see how more acceptable it say gets to make that more explicit in a way.
Yes, because at the moment, in order to have it on the NHS or to be talked about within a health context, it has to be stripped of any spiritual packaging and reduced to just a kind of secularized exercise.
Yeah.
But I think many people who do it may find that they actually find it fits better into a spiritual view of the world than a secular or purely secular and scientific one.
Yeah, I believe that the Dalai Lama, who sponsored a lot of the work on mindfulness in the US, talks about applied Buddhism, which is when certain very discrete practices within Buddhism are developed for addressing particular medical problems.
Yes.
There is the much wider worldview within which a whole way of life that may be much more healthy sits.
Yes.
And then I guess you get back into the spiritual tradition or the religious tradition.
Yes. Well, I don't... We've had a tradition for a long time in the West of people saying it's either or, but I think these are blurring the boundaries and we're getting much more to a kind of both and situation.
And it's interesting to me too because it's treating science in a different way. It's not treating science as, is this really true? You know, as if religion's about a set of beliefs that you have a checkbox and feel more or less comfortable asserting. But it's treating the relationship between science and religion much more as a practice, a kind of way of life.
Yes.
And insights or truths, as it were, might emerge at some point down the line. But
yes,
the recognition that it's a whole awareness or attitude towards life that you have to sort of work on.
Yes. Well, I think we're not going to solve all these problems in one discussion, but I think this is really an optimistic conclusion that we are actually... There is a new way forward emerging that wasn't obvious 20 years ago or 50 years ago.
Yeah.
A new way in which the scientific and religious traditions can work together and where science can actually contribute to spiritual practice.
And the spiritual insights can contribute to the science as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.